Patients expect the best outcome from their eye surgery. But what happens when the case isn't going as planned? Hear never-before-told stories from world-renowned eye surgeons about the most vulnerable moments of their careers. This is Ophthalmology Quicksand Chronicles with Drs. Nicole Fram and Elizabeth Yu, where we learn to pivot, reflect, and evolve as surgeons.
Hello, and welcome to the Quicksand Chronicles. We are your hosts. I'm Elizabeth Yu, and this is my co-host, the Dr. Nicole Fram.
Hello, everybody.
Don't forget that the ASCRS Ophthalmology Quicksand Chronicles is a podcast and a webcast, so you certainly can listen on your favorite platform and watch us on YouTube. So, Nicole, how have you been? How's your week?
My week is good. Everything's gone well. It's a difficult time. You know, there's a lot of cancellations. People are worried about COVID, but it's up. It's an up time because the vaccinations are coming out. And, you know, people are saying, yeah, I'll wait till next week. And, you know, we're just trying to encourage it, be grateful for what we have. I know last time we spoke, you were talking about how you needed to like chill, take a little break. And I know you took some time off over the holidays.
How
was it? What did you do? Anything new?
Okay. I'm not going to lie. We did go out of town, but it was just like family and just the four of us. And it was fine. And then, so my 13 and a half year old, my heart, okay, a little Yorkie poo, he passed away in August and I mourned. And then, but the thing, okay, so backtrack. So I'm, you know, raised as a single child. So my siblings have always been my first siblings. Right. Okay. I've had baby chickens. Okay. I played with crickets. I've had dogs, cats. You know, all the mix, right? So like this, beta fish. Okay.
Yeah, this explains a lot about you. So I'm just saying. Just saying.
My difficulty with English language. Yes. So I had, I've got two dogs, one for, you know, basically for Gabriel and Olivia. They came from South Korea. Okay. A little, the one's a teacup poodle, but he's already 7 pounds. That ain't no teacup poodle. But it's fine. It's fine. It might be because he's on an American diet. Who knows? And then and then Vivienne is a four-month-old Maltipoo. And she's just like little Chewbacca. Okay. I'll show you guys pictures next time. But girl, let me tell you, okay, like I've never had such smart dogs.
And well, they're Korean. Yeah. So, I mean, it's obvious.
Let me tell you, I think there's something to it. Okay. I think they bred some really intelligent, these dogs, like they are pad trained. Okay. They don't bark. They're crate trained and they understand Korean and English.
Wow. Like, wow.
Mind blown. Mind is blown. All right.
So you have two kids. So is each kid in charge of one dog or are you doing everything as usual?
Okay. So guilty pleasure. I still want to be number one in their lives. That's a little bit of the narcissism, right? But yes, my son is a little more rambunctious. So the boys, you know, in Coco and the boy dog, the 7 pound, big 7 pounder. And Olivia is got the little independent girl dog, but, and it's fine, you know, and they're, it is what it is. We're trying to teach them responsibility. I feel like I'm raising children again. I mean, like infants. I wake up every night at 2 a.m. to let them out to potty for poopification. It is killing me. Okay. I could do this when I was 30, but I can't do this at almost 50, whatever. Anyway, what is your guilty pleasure, Nicole?
Well, I mean, you know, we have been really thinking about, you know, what we wanted to do over the holidays. And I was just trying to like, get them off technology. And the bottom line is that I had to give up on that. And no shame.
No,
there is no shame in an iPad and there is no shame in a PlayStation. And so my guilty pleasure actually was, you know, getting back into yoga, getting back into walking. And if he wanted to join me, my son, Zach, then that was awesome. And if he didn't, he could just hang out on his iPad. But I did a lot of time reflecting about what we're doing here, how we're trying to reach, you know, the younger generation and the mids and the olders to kind of tell everybody we're all in the same boat. And I started thinking about my first day at Will's doing a FACO. And when I was in residency, we had to go to another county hospital for a little bit, get all the goodies out, and then we would go to Will's.
Get the what?
The goodies.
Okay.
That's a sensation that you get before you operate when you're nervous.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, it's good. You got to get the goodies out. Then we would go and it was, you were at the big show, right? So I'm in the Will's Eye Surgery Center and I'm operating with this amazing attending, Dr. K, who let us do a lot. And, you know, we sit down and I wanted to accommodate him. So I'm sitting way too high. Then he's like, oh, do you want to use this new FACO handpiece? And it was like a big handpiece, like a Neosonics. It was really big. So we sit down, I'm starting to FACO that, you know, the wound is good. The Rexus is good. I'm feeling like, oh, I can really do this. And all of a sudden we start FACOing and my hand turns into like a claw hand. So I literally couldn't undo my fingers to kind of rotate them and manipulate the handpiece. So I had to come out of the eye. And I don't know what your nurses were like, but Philly nurses don't like that. And they were like, who is this girl from LA? So the attending starts trying to help me massage my hand so I can keep doing the case. And this is all real. So then, of course, I was sitting too high. So then we start FACOing, but then both my legs fall asleep. So now I can't feel the foot pedals. I have claw hand and I have to stop again, get up and kind of like run around the room to get sensation back. So I'm making like a really good, really good first impression here. And then.
And what part are we at? Like, have you made the Rexus yet?
No, I was FACOing that the lens is out. So, you know, the lens was on, you know, we're about to do cortex, right? But I can't feel my feet. I can't feel my feet. I'm like, this is awesome. I am, you know, really making a great impression. So then I start like running around the room. I get my feet back. I finally say, hey, can we lower the bed a little bit? So we lower the bed and I can reach the foot pedals appropriately. And then I don't understand how it happened, but somehow the irrigation fluid, instead of going in the pocket, somehow went back right under my butt.
Like you were so, giving yourself a colonic cleanse?
I don't know. I mean, I probably would have felt better in that moment if I had done that. Uh-huh. And so I finished the case and I stand up and it looks like I peed my pants. And so these same nurses are looking at me like, wow, you know, just wow. And then one really nice nurse ran and got me new scrubs and blocked the door so I could change in the room. And I was just thinking about, how, you know, that you can only go uphill from there, right?
Right, so right.
Anyone who's in their residency or they feel like, oh, they had such a difficult case or their attending may be judging them, just think about me
and
you'll feel a lot better. So
I've learned a lot. Number one, you got to get your goodies out before you go to your first case because or else this is what happens. You become a claw hand. Who gives yourself a colonic cleanse during your first surgery?
Right.
But the case went well?
Case went well. Everything was fine. I was allowed to come back. Yeah.
Good.
And look at us now. Right?
Look at you. Yes.
Sponsors are everything at Ophthalmology Quicksand Chronicles. And we want to thank OSRX for being our sponsor today. So Liz, post-op care for cataract surgery, refractive surgery can be really complicated with all this drop regimen and trying to give out instructions. And OSRX has been a huge solution for our practice. And I remember at OSN a long time ago when we were asked, you know, what is the one thing that we've implemented in our practice that has made your practice run more smoothly and made your patient care better? You said OSRX. Can you tell me a little bit more about that?
100%. So for the past now 4 years, it has taken callbacks to our clinic way down in the magnitude order of at least two FTEs because of the size of the practice, callbacks on the branded that needs to be generic and all this confusion. We were able to standardize it and improve the patient experience by compounding multiple medications into a simple bottle to really simplify dosing. And the best part is the cap colors. So I can easily say you're going to use the pink cap medication, which has the antibiotic, steroid, and NSAID 3 times a day for 2 weeks, and then you'll switch over to the yellow cap. So this streamlined approach truly has reduced the barriers to use. It's made adherence easy. It's spared our patients from having to purchase multiple separate medications for surgery. And I've done it for at least now 4,000 or 5,000 patients, and it really has made a big difference. How about for you, Nicole?
Same thing. You know, we're pretty skeptical over here. We introduce a new technology, then we do a study on it, then we compare it. And so it's annoying, but we actually compared OSRX to the brand three-drop regimen. Yeah. And we found no difference in epithelial staining. We found no difference in MAC OCTs 1 month postoperatively. So I feel really confident when I tell a patient that this is just as good.
100%. We did the same thing retrospectively looking at it, particularly for clinical and subclinical CME, just like you were saying, endophthalmitis. But of course, we do intraoperative and intracameral medications. But still, really important to know that there is no difference as compared to the branded that we were using, and very comfortable. Omni by OSRX formulations are water soluble. They're certainly gentle on the cornea, and it's shipped directly to either the practice or the patients. So learn more at osrxpharmaceuticals.com. Sponsor out. I would like to introduce our amazing guest. And okay, straight up, my palms are sweating. Okay, I don't get nervous. Okay, I've been nervous for the last like 2 weeks, and I'm seriously like nervous. I mean, we have Eric Donenfeld, who, you know, he is a huge giant in our field. And that's not just figuratively, but obviously physically as well. But I mean, he has been a huge mentor to me, to Nicole. But what he does that's so special and unique beyond all of his accomplishments is that he cares so much. Eric Donenfeld has actually called me, emailed me when he's known that I was kind of deathly ill at one point, and said, listen to Uncle Eric, this is what you need to do. You know, so that's what makes Eric so special. He, in his nearly 30-year career, he just takes care of so many that have looked up to him. He's lectured, taught around the world, made significant advancements in our field. So interesting to know that first surgeon in the Northeast U.S. to perform laser cataract surgery, participated in numerous studies that actually led to the FDA approval of excimer laser technology, selected as an investigator for numerous other FDA clinical studies, past president of ASCRS, currently has been editor-in-chief of iWorld. He's written probably well over 200 peer-reviewed papers on cornea, external disease, complex cataract, refractive surgery, numerous, you know, book chapters. I mean, and it's so well-deserved that he is a recipient of Lifetime Achievement Awards, the AAO Secretariat Award. So I am so honored that the Eric Donenfeld, who is just the spiffiest of dressers, is with us today.
Oh gosh, you guys are amazing. I'm sitting here listening to you and said, I don't really want to say anything. I want to listen to the two of you talk. You guys are so amazing. It's so great to hear both of you talking. And you know, if you mind, I'm going to just tell a quick story, because Nicole, you told your story about your first cataract. My first cataract was a little bit of a different story, but just as memorable. I was at Manhattan Eye and Ear, And at that time, we had the giants in ophthalmology there. It was an amazing place. And I chose Arnie Church, who was the top cataract surgeon at the time, to assist me in my first case. And he was my idol. I mean, I loved that man. I wanted to be him when I grew up. And I chose him for my first cataract. And just like you said, Nicole, my first cataract, I'm nervous. I go into the OR. I do the case. And the gods of cataract surgery are behind me. And I get the first case done. And it goes great. The first cataract is wonderful. It's like I have created fire. I have restored vision. It's the most amazing feeling. And this is what Arnie Church said to me. And this is what I say to every single ophthalmologist I take through their first cataract. I say exactly the words that Arnie Church told me. He goes, Eric, he goes, you have all the tools. He goes, you can be a great ophthalmologist. What you need to remember is the same feeling of euphoria you have today with your first case. If you can capture that on every single surgery you do for the rest of your career, you're going to have an amazing career. And I still feel that same way. And every time I do a case, I think of Arnie Church and how I felt on that first day when I did my first cataract surgery. And that's the best advice I give to residents when they do their first case. I go, capture that moment and hold on to it.
Right. Oh,
that's the best.
You know, Eric, it's such a great thing to have you here. And one of the things that I love about you is how you influence the younger generation. So you make people just like you were talking about, you make people believe in themselves. You make people want to contribute to ophthalmology. And, you know, I was just wondering why you thought that putting me in a fat ballerina suit, my first time on the stage of the American Academy of Ophthalmology, was a way that you were going to further my career. So just set this up for people.
Well, we're at Amar Agarwal runs a program every year at the Academy where we compete and we have different teams. And I was captaining my team and you have to wear costumes. And I said to myself, if we're going to do this, let's just go all the way. And I have to tell you, Nicole, you rocked that outfit. I mean, very few people could pull that off, but you looked amazing. And, you know, one of the things I like to do is I like to educate. And that's what I love about you two. You two educators as well. But education is not just about education. It's about having fun and conveying that fun to people in the audience. So they want to get involved. They feel like this is a fun thing to do and they want to be involved. And when you're standing there giving a serious lecture and educating people wearing that outfit, people are going to remember it.
Right.
So I guarantee it. People remember that.
Yeah. So for all the listeners who aren't looking at the webcast right now, we were the sumo wrestling team. And I thought, you know, I was only female on the team. So I wanted to be a sumo ballerina wrestler. So this is, you gotta get on the webcast to see this. It's really an incredible moment. But somehow you made me feel like I was doing something normal. And so we love that about you. Then you go ahead and keep the party going. So, I mean, now we're showing a picture of us dressed up as Elvis, which with Tal Raviv and George Biko. It's just interesting. And you're just dominating. I mean, you got the chest showing. Do you enjoy it? Do you love Halloween? Is this your thing?
Can we stop 1 second?
I actually do love Halloween. It's one of my favorite holidays. Every year, my staff and I get dressed up, and I could share photos with you. But like this year, I was the devil. And actually, I'm wearing my devil costume right now. I wanted to bring my A game, but so I said to myself, I'm with Nicole Frem and Liz Yu. I have to bring it today.
Let's on go with there. The show. So remember, everybody, this podcast is all truly, I mean, it's a lot of fun, but it's about vulnerability and how we can channel that vulnerability into us all becoming better surgeons. So what happens when a surgery starts to go in the wrong direction? And how do we pivot, rebound, get back on track in order to get better results through that case and for future cases?
And before we get into the surgery, which we're really excited, we have two cases and we're really excited to see, why the eye? You know, why did you go into ophthalmology? Give us some background on how you got here.
Well, it's really a sappy story, Nicole. I don't know if you've ever heard it before, but I grew up on Long Island next to a farm. And I was at the farm playing with the farm, and the farmer slaughtered some pigs. And he actually literally put a pig's eye in my hand when I was in second grade. Now, if you did it today, you'd probably put that guy in jail. But he put a pig's eye in my hand, and I brought it home. And my mom, to her credit, looked at it and didn't scream. She said, wait till your dad gets home. We'll see what he thinks. And my dad looked at it. He was a physician. And we dissected that pig eye. And I knew all the parts of the eye when I was like 7 or 8 years old. And I kept that pig eye on my night table in formaldehyde for like 2 years. And I, at that age, I knew I wanted to be an eye doctor. That's all I ever wanted to do. And that's, you know, that was a start. That's all I ever wanted to do, Nicole. It was to me, it was the easiest choice. There's nothing more important than giving people vision. And it's a passion. And I think you and Liz really exemplify that passion. Both of you have fun, but you're such dedicated, hardworking individuals. You are such amazing role models for everyone out there. Look at what Nicole and Liz do and emulate them. And if you can be half as passionate and half as wonderful as they are, you're going to have amazing careers.
Tell us, I mean, what was it like, Eric the father, Eric the full-time doctor, surgeon, all the talks you were giving, everything that you were doing, what was it like?
Well, you know, I have to give amazing credit to my wife, Marlene. Marlene has been my anchor for many years. And every now and then when I get a little full of myself or I wouldn't be paying proper attention, she would settle me down in a way that only she can do and tell me what the real priorities were. And the real priorities were always my family first. And I always, you know, went out of my way. So I would, you know, I wouldn't play golf. I might miss a little sleep, but I was always there. And the family always was a top priority for me. And I got involved in academics. And in the beginning of my career, I spent most of my time writing and doing research. And I didn't go to a lot of meetings. I went to some, but I didn't go to a lot. And then as the kids got older and they were out of the house and my wife said, go for it. And that's when I started, you know, going to all the meetings and speaking and traveling and doing all the things. But you have to be balanced about this. And I'm so fortunate to have a wife who really knew what was important for me more than I knew what was important for me. And at the end of the day, I did have it all. I got to do everything that I wanted to do and do it the right way.
It's incredible.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's such a struggle though to people talk about the balance and there's no balance. It's a juggle. And, you know, in the beginning of my career, I'm like, oh, they asked me to do something. I'm going to do it. They asked me again. Well, I can't say no. And really finally I've realized the importance of family and being there for my family. And you saying that, you know, means a lot to us to help us prioritize, you know, what we're doing. One of the things that's so incredible about you is that, you know, you are the go-to person for a lot of industry and companies that want to start up and contribute to ophthalmology. And one of the things that's a struggle is how do you pick a company that you want to invest your time in? And then how do you make sure that you hold on to the ethics of medicine when you're speaking for many different companies?
You know, whenever I work with a company, what I'm saying to myself is this what's best for patients? And at the end of the day, when you look at the opportunities that are out there and you can realistically say that this is a good thing for patients, then you can put your full weight behind it. If it's not good for patients, then you shouldn't be interested in it. And the companies that I work with understand that and they know that. There are some people who work with companies who just will say yes to everything and they support everything. And the companies that I work with, they know that if something is not working right, I'm not going to be supporting it. And I don't align myself with companies and just work with one company. I work with all the companies because that's the only way that you can be true to yourself and advance the profession. And it's really a lot of fun. And changing the way ophthalmologists practice has been one of the most exciting parts of my life. And you know, there's nothing more valuable than providing people with better vision. And I view what we do as a partnership with industry because what we do wouldn't be possible without the support of industry. Industry needs ophthalmologists like you and Liz, and we need them just as much. So I've had a great relationship with industry, and I would encourage anyone who has the opportunity to embrace it, because it opens up amazing doors and challenges that you wouldn't find anywhere else.
So there you have it, a little bit about Eric Donofell, not just the Eric extraordinaire that you see at the meetings, but just on a more personal level. Speaking of our relationships with industry, it's perfect timing for us to talk a little bit about our sponsor, BVI. So BVI has, as you know, great custom packs, single-use items. We've talked about their IOLs, as we did in our last episode. Eric, Nicole, and I have been able to work with them in different ways. And I would say that the speed and the simplicity of which they can deliver their products and the ease of how they can create those customized packs and everything for us, that's very unique. You can't find that with necessarily different companies that you work with. So that scalability is a true testament to BVI's professionalism. Eric, what's your experience like working with them?
Well, I would just reiterate what you're saying here today, Liz. BVI has been one of my favorite companies to work with. They have great products. They make a difference. They provide the personal protective equipment that we need in this COVID age. They make disposable instruments that are extraordinary. They're just as good as my regular instruments. And I've really enjoyed the relationship. But, you know, there are two aspects to a company. A company has to be not only providing great products, but they have to be great people. And the people at BVI are just good people. I love their new IOL that they just came out with. I think it's optically amazing. It's clear. It provides quality vision. But when COVID hit New York, where I live, and it was really horrible, and the nurses and hospitals didn't have gowns to wear, they didn't have protective equipment, BVI came to me and they said, we'd like to donate 100,000 personal protective equipment to the hospitals in New York. And they came to me and they asked me if I could help them make that relationship, and they did that. And they didn't get any credit for it. No one knew about it, but they stepped forward at a time of crisis, and I appreciate that. And those type of relationships last a lifetime.
That's fantastic. Same thing. You know, I was doing some mission work, and, you know, we just want sometimes getting stuff that is, you know, expired, right? I just asked BVI if they had any expired disposable blades and other equipment that we could use, syringes. You know, within 24 hours, they just sent over boxed a bunch of things that we could use for transplants, for corneas and cataract surgery. And I mean, that just means so much. And it clearly wasn't anything expired that they sent over, but it was, you know, I mean, one small request and they just go above and beyond. And that's really appreciated.
Let's get into the meat of the Quicksand Chronicles. We want to talk about, Eric, your moment, your cases where you felt that you were in quicksand. Take it away, Eric.
Okay, well, I'm happy to do that. I've been in quicksand a few times in my career. And what I don't like about this case is that I can make physical mistakes and I can live with it, but this was a mental mistake that I make. And I find that more unforgivable. I've been following you two on Quicksand Chronicles, and I love the demeanor. I love listening to it because we all have complications. And it's how you respond to complications that really makes a difference. Let me present this case. I call this vitreous lost and vitreous found. And all of us have had a problem where we lost vitreous. It happens pretty routinely. And how you handle vitreous is so important. And this is a case I did a number of years ago, and I'm doing a routine capsulotomy. And I'm operating, and I'm just flipping the lens up. And I don't notice it the first time around, but I'm going to stop right there and see superiorly on your screen. And by the way, I operate from above Liz and Nicole. The reason for that is I can't get my legs under the table from the side. So you talk about your feet hanging over the ground. I can't, my feet are banging against the table when I'm moving it. It's almost impossible. I do a case every month or so from the side and I hate it every moment of it.
So do the scrub nurses have to stand up when they operate with you?
No, I can drop a table down.
You can drop it down.
I can drop it down. So I'm operating here and you can see here, that there is a anterior capsular tear that's occurred. And I didn't see it at this point. When I went back and I looked at the video, I did see the tear there. That's an important finding, because when you see an anterior capsular tear, you can live with that. But if it starts wrapping around and becomes a posterior capsular tear, then you have some significant problems that you have to deal with. So I was in India a couple of years back, and I saw a presentation that I really liked by a woman, Tushya Parkesh, who wrote a paper in JCRS about this sign. And what's interesting is if you see an anterior capsular tear, the capsule will flutter and move anteriorly. That means that it hasn't wrapped around. Gotcha. Once it wraps around, it lays down flat and won't flutter. So that's a sure sign. So at this point, it's an anterior capsular tear. And at this point, if I had noticed it, I would have done a few things. I might have put some viscoelastic in that area. I probably would have turned my infusion height down. I would have reduced my vacuum a little bit. There are a couple of things that I could have done here. I didn't recognize it, but the case moves on from here. So let's keep going with the case.
Eric, don't you hate it when it's like this is like a pristine red reflex? That always concerns me, that I've compromised the capsule and now we've got some vitreous, because it's so clear of a view. I'm just going to throw that out there.
Yeah, when you pop the capsule, you'll usually see a deepening of the chamber and you'll see a widening of the pupil. It kind of just pops. That hadn't happened yet. I hadn't seen that. But that's one of the things you're obviously going to be concerned with when you have an anterior capsule tear, hoping that it doesn't wrap around. What you want to do in those circumstances, you want to avoid going into that area of the eye. You want to kind of stay away from them and move the surgery up into the anterior chamber and move it away from that quadrant as best you can. So I'm marching on and I'm doing my surgery. And at this point, I recognize that I do have a tear, and I'm going to see it right about now. So I stopped my video at this point. Now I see the tear and it's still fluttering a little bit. It's gotten a little wider from where you saw it before. And at this point, I realize that there's a problem, and now I react to it for the first time. And when I react to it, the knee-jerk response is to take your instruments out of your eye. And Nicole, that's a bad idea, right?
It's a real bad idea. Yeah. That's called denial.
Exactly. So at this point, I actually do the right thing. I leave my phaco in on irrigation, and I take my side port instrument out, and I put in a dispersive viscoelastic to help me there. I come out, viscoelastic goes in, I just visco dissect that area, I push the lens nucleus out of the way, and I'm just filling up the chamber now with a dispersive viscoelastic. And what I'm doing here is I'm actually visco dissecting these little nuclear fragments. I don't want to go in here with a phaco or an IA into that quadrant. So I'm actually using viscoelastic to push these little pieces of cortex and nucleus out of the way. But I'm noticing here now that I clearly have a tear.
Yeah.
So now the tear is extended posteriorly, and you can see that the capsule has laid down flat, and there's you can see the posterior capsule is open, and now I'm worried about vitreous loss, right?
Right. And just for the audience who are listening in, I mean, it looks like the anterior capsule is disconnected, but they're not just, it's not flaps next to each other. They're about three quadrants apart. And I could see what looks to be a split posteriorly, but it looks like the compromise is mid periphery across the capsule. Would you agree there?
Yeah, no, that's exactly right, Liz. And so the tear has gone around. It hasn't wrapped around and become an Argentine flag sign. It hasn't basically torn the entire posterior capsule, but it's just in that little quadrant. There's a little tear there that's wrapped around. It hasn't gone the full extent. So now I'm using IA. I'm feeding the small quadrants in. And at this point, I've got to put a lens in the eye.
Eric, I'm sorry to stop you there. I think the part that's so nerve-wracking is that you still had, you know, a quarter of the nucleus still left to remove, right? And it's one thing if you are almost finished and you're just getting little pieces out when the posterior capsule has been violated. What if you have a lot of nucleus in there and you notice that you violated the capsule and it wrapped around sooner? What would you do in that scenario?
Well, that's a great opportunity for a scaffolding technique. You can put in a three-piece posterior chamber lens and just lay it underneath the nucleus, and you can actually have the haptics stay on top of the iris.
Right.
And that can act as a nice barrier or safety net. I think a scaffolding is actually the wrong word. It should be really called a safety net technique.
Right.
And you just lay that down there, and then you can do your phaco with that barrier providing protection so that those little nuclear chips don't fall into the vitreous. Especially so, important when you have a larger tear than this.
Right. And so, but if you go back into phaco and you have, you know, the safety net or scaffold underneath and you hear this like ding, 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 what is that?
That's a very bad sign. You're right.
Do you ever just levitate and then widen your wound and kind of just scooch it out manually?
Yeah.
Well, if I have a lot of nucleus there, a large piece, you know, I'll go to a larger incision. And I'll basically almost do an extra cap if I need to. Mm-hmm. I do like to avoid that. I like having the control of having a small incision, because when you enlarge the incision, good things happen, but bad things can also happen.
But you can also move, right? So you can close up your superior incision, but you can't move because your legs are too long. But you can move and you can make a scleral tunnel and you can say, okay, I'm now doing an extra cap, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. That's actually a very wise choice. That is a completely reasonable thing to do under certain circumstances. Here, 80% of the posterior capsule is still intact.
Exactly.
I had that little cap, that little area down below. So I'm going to put in a 3-piece lens here. I mean, that's I think what we'd all do. And I want to put it in very gently. So I think I'm using here an LI61AO, which is kind of my go-to lens when I want to use a 3-piece. I like it because it's a zero aberration lens. It's made by Bausch & Lomb. It's a very nice lens under these circumstances. And I'm putting it in, and I'm being very fastidious with it. I've got viscoelastic there. And the lens is going in. And I want to make sure that the lens is just under the iris or even on top of the iris if I have to. I want to make sure it doesn't go posteriorly. And I'm rotating into position. I want to end up making sure the haptics are not in the area where the capsule tear has occurred. So I've rotated around now, and it's in pretty good position here right now. I'm getting it, just tucking it in right under the iris in front of the capsule here. There's some small pieces of cortex here that are still there, but the lens is in great position here.
Are you worried at all that there's a big gap of those 3 clock hours?
I'm a little bit worried, but I think I've got enough support on the right side of the screen, and I've got the haptic extending exactly from the edge of the tear around. So I've got like 3 clock hours of control there, and I'm actually pressing on the lens. I'm looking for the support. I'm making sure it doesn't rock or doesn't move, and the lens is in pretty good position, and it's not moving. I'm kind of happy where it is right now. So I'm pretty good. I still don't know if I've got vitreous in the anterior chamber, though, and I can't be certain about that. I haven't had any of that dinging noise that you asked about before, but I can't be certain about that. But one thing I am certain about, it's never wrong to put triamcinolone in an eye.
Right.
I don't think we do that enough. I think we should do that a lot more. It's kind of my go-to. If there's no vitreous there, I put steroid in an eye and the eye is going to be quiet. Some of these eyes, we have the worst complications. They come back the next day and they look amazing the next day. And the reason for that is the triamcinolone is a wonderful steroid inside the eye and it hides a lot of sins. If you do see vitreous, you want to make sure you get rid of it. So I'm going to put a little triamcinolone in the eye. I'm rocking the lens. It's pretty stable. It's in good position. I take it the viscoelastic. Now, I'm going to stop here for a second also. Liz, Nicole, would you do an IA here or would you do a manual viscoelastic removal at this point? What would you be doing?
See, I preach manual, especially because right now, I mean, I don't know. I'm just saying there's 3 clock hours where I feel like it's just missing capsule. There's like 20% and this lens could, I mean, the fluidics of it, this can just kind of deep six. Is that the right term? But, you know, or V can come up. I mean, the fluidics can shift so quickly, especially with cohesive viscoelastic, that V can just come up as well. I mean, I've seen it both, and it's because I've made those errors, you know?
What I usually do is come out, I put a suture in my wound, and I go by manual. And if I do think there's vitreous, I'll just switch to the Vitrector and first on cut IA and then go to IA cut. But like Liz says, it's like you can feel the eye and you can feel your nerves also. And if you feel that you have an unstable chamber, then, you know, taking the viscoelastic out, you know, with a 27 gauge cannula on BSS and sucking the viscoelastic out, pushing more BSS and sucking more is a more controlled way to do it. Plus, you can't stain with triamcinolone until you get a little bit of that viscoelastic out, because you won't be able to see if there's really vitreous or it's caught up on OVD.
Yeah, I love your idea of bimanual. If I did this again, I would probably do a manual irrigation, go with a 27 gauge cannula, just irrigate, just get a blob of viscoelastic amount. If you're going to do it with a mechanized technique, lower the bottle down. This right. bottle is probably about 40 or 50 centimeters high rather than the normal 150. Right. But there's nothing more frustrating than doing a perfect case, getting to this point, and then putting your IA in and having the vitreous just kind of pop out after it hasn't right. been there because you did an IA. So right. I don't mind leaving a little viscoelastic behind. I can always, you know, next day, you know, put the patient on some Diamox. I can get through the day or two of pressure spikes, but I'd rather not do a vitrectomy if I can avoid it.
So Eric, well, like, I feel like the way you're talking about the case, it's like you're in total control. What are you feeling inside? I mean, you've been operating for a little while. And what do you, I mean, every time, it doesn't happen often. So you are caught off guard. How do you mobilize the room and keep yourself on track when this is happening? And does the staff know, you know, things are happening?
The staff knows. And my philosophy on surgery is that every time you go in with a plan, have a backup plan. Anything you think you're going to do, always have plan B and plan C available. And I think in the next case, we'll go into that a little bit more. But you should always have a backup plan of what might be needed. And you need to know where things are and how to mobilize things. And one of the keys here, when you have a complication, is not to panic. It's almost never a problem to do nothing. If you stop and assess the situation, you're always going to be better off than acting quickly and trying to make a split-second decision, because there's nothing wrong with just stopping and looking at it, maybe getting a second opinion. Ask somebody else if you have someone else nearby who you might want to get their opinion and say, you know, pop into the room and take a look. What would you do here? But I think the key here is to maintain your cool, stop, look, listen, think about it, and think about your backup plan. And when your backup plan is being mobilized, have everything in the room that you might need at that time. So at this point, I've told them, have the vitrectomy set up. Don't set it up, but have it ready. Have the triamcinolone in the office. I want to have some myostat as well. There are a lot of little things that are going in through my mind right now that I'm thinking about. So I'm done. I'm putting a little triamcinolone in the eye. After I take out my viscoelastic, the lens is in great position. Here's the triamcinolone going in. I love triamcinolone. This, I think, is Triessence. It's an Alcon product. I irrigate it out. You can use Kenalog as well. Irrigate it out. And
so you manually irrigated it out.
I'm manually irrigating it out. Yeah, I'm just manually irrigating it out. And I don't see any vitreous. Mm-mm. I'm done. And at this point, I should walk away with my head held high, saying that I made the best of a difficult circumstance and everything went well. This is my quicksand moment right now. And that is that for some reason, I wasn't thinking. What would you do here at this point? Would you try to posterior capture this lens? Would that be a good idea?
Not intentionally.
So no. I'm testing it and I said, I'm going to posterior capture it.
Yeah.
So I press the lens to capture it.
No.
Vitreous pops up from below. I put some more triamcinolone in the eye.
Oh, hold on. You can't do optic capture of any sort unless you have a curvilinear anterior or posterior curvilinear opening.
It's got to be continuous.
Thank you. And curvilinear.
That's my mistake here. So you're absolutely right. I'm not sure what I was thinking. It was a mistake, but this is the worst kind of mistake. This is the one I'm most embarrassed about. It was a mental mistake. It wasn't a physical mistake. I just relaxed at that point. And I said to myself, let me capture this. And you have to have an intact capsule to do this, at least an intact anterior capsule to do this. And I did not. And when I pressed in the eye, it popped up. And there was just no reason to do that at all. So at this point, I had to do a bimanual vitrectomy. I elected to do an anterior vitrectomy here. I could have done posterior, but I thought the anterior was reasonable. Did my vitrectomy. You can see that the lens is shifting a little bit.
How did you know that vitreous popped? Did the eye get harder, or was it a shimmy of the lens? Was the lens no longer centering? Was it at the wound? What made you realize that? All of the above?
All of the above, Liz. All of the above. What happened here is the inferior part of the lens just tilted up. Vitreous was pushing the lens. So instead of lens lying perpendicular or horizontal, it just tilted up and it moved anteriorly and it moved forward. And I knew vitreous had popped forward into the anterior chamber.
Aaron's gospel.
Yeah. So that was my quicksand moment.
Eric, I noticed that your vitrector, is your vitrector through your coaxial, your main incision, or?
No, I've actually I've gone just to the side of it.
Okay, good. So you made a separate pair.
Smaller incision here. Good. And it's going in very nicely. But here I am just done the vitrectomy. There's a little vitreous there. I swept the wood. I went in a little more. You can see some triamcinolone in the eye. The lens is well centered again. It's exactly where I left it before. Mm-hmm. And the patient actually did very, very well. But this was a quicksand moment. And it made me realize that when you have a difficult case, you can't relax until the speculum is out of the eye. You have to keep your focus at all times. And again, have your plan and have your backup plan.
That's fantastic. That's so true.
It's a little more interesting. Let's get to the next case here. Let me actually pop this up here.
Is the next case a little more devilish?
A little more devilish.
Maybe you should put on.
Yeah.
Since you're a big Halloween guy, a big costume guy. Yeah.
That's
what I expect.
Oh my gosh.
So Eric has now put on his devil horns.
Ladies
and gentlemen.
You see, he is not that intimidating. Uncle Eric is not that intimidating. He's lovable. Sorry.
There you are. this is an honor of my friend Terry Kim and Priya Gupta, who are dookies, and they wear their horns all the time. So just give me a little bit of a devil outfit here, but I'm going to take this off. It does look a little silly.
Okay.
But
that's okay.
Let's go on to the next case. So I'll set this one up. This is a patient who had cataract surgery. This was done elsewhere, the proverbial elsewhere. And the patient had an UGG syndrome, uveitis, glaucoma, hemorrhage. There was blood circulating in the anterior chamber. There was some iris atrophy and the patient's pressure was up. And of course, you want to make certain, but the lens was in the sulcus. There's a one-piece lens in the sulcus rather than in the capsular bag. And the haptics were rubbing against the posterior surface of the iris, creating the uveitis glaucoma hemorrhage. And the way you manage this is you have to either reposition or remove the lens. Those are your options here. And this had been gone for a long time. The capsular bag was closed. So I decided that I was going to remove the lens. So let's get started on the case. I call this uveitis glaucoma syndrome management. I'm using a dispersive viscoelastic. The lens is in the sulcus, so I don't have to really pop it out. And I'm just using a hook to just basically rotate the haptics into the anterior chamber. Whenever I do an IOL exchange, Nicole and Liz, and maybe I'm going to ask you about this as well. I'd like to hear what your opinions are. These cases can be really easy and they can go extraordinarily well, or they don't. So I always do a peribulbar block on all these cases because I never know where they're going. Do you block all your patients that you're doing IOL exchanges on, or do you do them under topical sometimes?
I absolutely block. I block for a number of reasons. One is exactly what you said. You have no idea how long it's going to go. The other is that you don't want a patient squeezing or having any issue, especially if the posterior capsule is open during the case. So I don't value topical or speed in these cases.
Yep. So I block all of them. And the reason is that these cases can be a 3-minute case and you can be in and be out, or this case can happen. So I'm taking the lens out, I'm getting to the anterior chamber and I'm putting the lens up, and I like to use lens cutters. There's a lot of different, I like MSTs, but my favorite lens cutters are absolutely by my good friend, Dick McCool. Dick's a good close friend of mine. I admire him greatly. He's just amazing. And they're bulky, but they cut everything. So I like to do what's called a Pac-Man technique. There are a lot of different ways of doing this. And I pull the lens out. I rotate it 90 degrees. and take the second part out, and the lens comes out very easily.
So with the Pac-Man technique, how far across the central optic do you cut?
I like to go about 90% across. You can go as little as 50% and it'll still work. 90% makes it a little bit easier. You can see why they call it a Pac-Man technique. It looks a little bit like Pac-Man, which, by the way, that came out while I was a resident. And I used to go play Pac-Man with my good chief resident buddy, Vinny Givinazzo. We used to play Pac-Man. We used to make believe we were doing vitrectomies. It was like our first foray into OR. And we used to sit there playing Pac-Man. It was just a lot of fun.
You know, so, Eric, I have a love-hate relationship, mainly hate right now, with the Pac-Man technique. If it's not an Acrosoft lens. So if it's an Acrosoft lens, I think it works really well because that material is not as stiff. I have a horrible case that I just experienced with the Technis where I was doing the Pac-Man technique, but I wasn't watching the distal portion of it. And it disinserted the iris as it was flipping. So what you did was beautiful because you were watching as you were rotating out of the eye. And I've seen some people actually hold with a micro forceps the other side of it as they're rotating it out. And so I think that's just a little point about the Pac-Man technique. It looks really slick and it is great, but you got to watch that distal portion so it doesn't flip and cause an iris trauma.
You're absolutely right about that. And that's really true. Even if you're gonna fold the lens or you're gonna cut the lens 100% across so that you have two halves, there's a very big difference between how soft that, for example, the Acrosoft is, or like silicone or a hydrophilic acrylic. That's one end of the spectrum. And just another pearl, the other end of the spectrum are various hydrophobic acrylics that are actually that you can excise, including the Technis and the Invista. They're so rigid. And because of the square edge, I mean, you can easily cause disinsertion and angle hemorrhages as you're trying to manipulate it. So just watch out what's going on distally. Don't just keep your field of focus just at your temporal wound.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right.
Yeah, so there's a lot of good learning points here. So I'm taking a look. You can see the blood here. The blood is from the uveitis glaucoma syndrome. Wow. So now the question is IOL management. What are you going to do here? And again, this is a case where I've decided I'm going to do a three-piece lens. So a good red reflex. I thought I see the capsule here. I'm putting the lens in, and I'm similar to the last case. I'm just angling the lens in and putting it right under the iris, trying to get it on top of the capsule. And this is going to be about a 3-minute case. I should rotate the lens into position and I should be all done.
So do you ever suture these lenses to the iris or do you just hope they don't dislocate?
Occasionally I do that, Nicole, but I really don't do so many. I will suture a lens that's already inside the eye. But if I'm putting a new lens in, under these circumstances, I'd rather use Amar Agarwal's glued IOL, or I'd rather use Yamani technique usually. I don't usually do a primary suturing. I only suture when the lens is already in the eye, and I just want to quickly suture it to the iris. What do you like to do?
Well, I think if I have sulcus to support, and these single-piece acrylic lenses do not belong in the sulcus because of the thick, tacky haptics that rub also the edge of the lens, but it's really those tacky haptics. But if I have at least 270 degrees of support, then I feel comfortable putting a three-piece in secondarily and then doing a very light, I call it like iris suture fixation light, where I don't want to cinch it down tightly and cause a cat eye pupil. I just want to keep it there because what I notice is sometimes it'll kind of move over time. So
Would you do that in a patient that you know already has secondary glaucoma?
It's all about the lens material. So you notice that he put in a friendly lens for the sulcus. So that was an LI61AO soft port lens. So I do feel like that's perfectly fine because why does UGG happen? It's happening because of those thick haptics. It's not happening because you have something in the sulcus necessarily. If you have the wrong thing in the sulcus.
Hey, Nicole, when you do that, do you suture it on both sides or just one side when you do a suture light?
Both sides. Yeah. And, you know, it works nicely because I think I told this, you know, the last time my partner, Sam Maskett, would say, you got to suture it. And I would say, yeah, I don't have to suture it. It looks good. And then all of a sudden they started going like this and moving over time. And then I said, okay, I'll listen now. So that's why I do it that way.
Great. Okay. So I'm putting the lens in, and this is an uneventful case, and I'm going to be out of this case in about 1 minute to go. And the lens is going in, and all of a sudden, you don't really see it on the video so well, but what's happening now is the lens is starting to dislocate. It's actually turning on its side, and the distal haptic is heading straight down towards red. It looks like the Titanic is about to sink in the middle of the ocean. And I'm sitting there, and I'm looking at it, and I'm saying to myself, what is happening here? And there's just no capsule support, and the lens is just falling into the vitreous, and I'm sitting there. What do you do? I mean, what do you do under these circumstances? You want to respect the vitreous. On the other hand, you don't want the lens to fall into the posterior pole and have to, call up your vitreoretinal friend and say, hey, I lost another one. So what do you do here? So I used what I had. At that point, all I have basically is a Sinsky hook. So I take the Sinsky hook and I grab the haptic and I hold on to it for dear life. It's like clinging onto the life raft here.
Right.
But just notice here, just for everyone to see, that's the one thing. Oftentimes lenses, even if it goes in this direction and it's starting to turn the wrong direction, going vertical, just from the buoyancy of the vitreous and the fact that you have viscoelastic, if you are maintaining the fluidics and you're being conservative, it doesn't just sink all of a sudden. It's not like it's gone within a blink of the eye. It just moves slowly. And it will stay relatively in that position and just make intentional movements as you see Eric doing here, which then you can gently capture to lift the actual lens into the anterior chamber.
Right. So that's what I want to do. Exactly. I want to get this lens into the anterior chamber. That's my goal. Nicole, you want to say something? I'm sorry.
I was going to say, what are you calling out? What are you saying to your staff?
Right. So that's exactly what you should be doing, Nicole. Now I've got my plan B set up. So now what I'm saying to myself is now I need some micro forceps. I need to be able to manipulate the lens. I want to get my MST forceps out here. I want to get a vitrectomy set up. And I basically just want to get this lens in the anterior chamber. I want to get some more viscoelastic onto the table. But the first thing I'm really looking for is some micro forceps. I want to be able to hold on to that haptic and prevent it from falling backwards. So that usually takes a couple minutes. These are not on the table at this point. So they've got it in the room, but they've got to open it up. They've got to put it together. And they've got to hand it. Mm-hmm. That's what's happening right now. Doesn't this look like quicksand a little bit?
This is
quicksand, literally.
My head is barely above the water level here, and my whole body is sinking posteriorly, and I'm having that sinking feeling that I'm about to go down. So this is a perfect quicksand moment here.
A lot of times I'll say, okay, I need the MST microsurgical forceps. And they scream out, get the emergency kit. And it's not really something that you want your patient to hear, because get the emergency, MST kit. And so just a little side note. To train your staff to just call it microsurgical forceps.
So Eric, if they don't have an MST kit, okay, they don't have that emergency kit, what other kind of intraocular forceps can be utilized here?
Any long thin forceps could be used. You could actually use a Utrata forceps. You could use a long angled McPherson forceps would be good. You probably have to make the incision a little bit larger to do that. But any one of those forceps, if you don't have it available, would be good. Nicole, you're absolutely right about that, by the way. And all you want to do is you want to shout out, whoops. And that's the one word that you never want to do. And the other thing I'm doing, by the way, is I'm not saying anything, but I'm taking my hand like this and I'm turning to the anesthesiologist and I'm going like this.
More.
Yes.
Which means give him a little more.
Oh, yeah. I'm like this. Yeah. 10 minutes down.
I'm saying, go before a little Versit on board. We want to make sure everyone's relaxed here and then save some for me.
Yeah, totally.
So the lens is starting to sink. So I grab it. Now we're coming back and we have the MST forceps and I'm basically using the forceps and I'm just rotating the lens into the anterior segment and the lens is now into the anterior segment. And now I'm feeling a little bit more comfortable. What am I doing now, by the way? I'm looking for that capsule. I can't figure out where that capsule went. I can't find that capsule. This is a magical disappearing capsule. So I'm looking. Do you ever use
hooks? Ever heard of iris hooks?
Well, at this point, you don't need iris hooks really because there's no capsule. If I had capsule, I'd put hooks in. I just want to see if it's there. If it's there, then I'm going to put hooks in. But if it's not there, I just want to know. I can use it. I can use any type of forceps. Yeah, Kugelhans hook works really well. And I'm looking for it. And I don't say, here's my Kugelhans. I'm pushing. No capsule there.
It's gone.
I'm kind of in a little bit of disbelief. So now I've got to go to plan B.
Right.
Actually, this is plan C we're on now. So now I'm plan C. I got my three-piece lens in the anterior segment. How am I going to insert this IOL? So Nicole, you know, I watched you give courses in this. You're one of the leading experts now on scleral fixation. What would you do here?
Well, I think it really depends on where you are emotionally and where you are in your career, right? So if this was my first 10 cases of exchanging a lens, I would probably, you know, pressurize the eye, make sure that I have some sort of stability. I want to stabilize this eye. And then I would most likely in my beginning of my career, I may just remove the IOL and come back another day, right? It's very stressful what you just went through. But if I'm further on in my career and I've done a bunch of these cases, I can think about trying to use this lens and fixating this lens in a scleral fixation manner. But I got to stabilize the eye. I need to put infusion in so that I can mark appropriately and know where I am and have the eye pressurized to do an intrascleral haptic fixation technique. I need to make sure I have a proper vitrectomy before I start putting things through the pars plana. So that's kind of where I'm going.
Agreed. And by the way, I'm going to put a little thought out there. And that is, it's absolutely reasonable if you don't feel comfortable, leave the lens out, like Nicole said, or put an anterior chamber lens in. Anterior chamber lenses are still a reasonable alternative for people who don't feel comfortable doing the gymnastics that Nicole is talking about.
As long as you have the proper sizing.
Yeah. That's right.
Talk to me. How do you size an ACIOL?
I don't think there is a good way, Nicole.
I know.
I mean, it's like... White to white plus one. I mean,
right. But then Maskett taught me white to white plus a half. And that seems to work a little bit better. But how many people have an MT 4U, 3U, 2U on
5U?
How many people have that in stock? So the biggest complications that I see is someone panicking and shoving an ACIOL in the eye. So I would say just take the lens out and stop. And then come back.
Very reasonable.
So if there's no capsule, would you consider iris fixation? For me, I will not do an iris fixation unless there's at least some capsule remnant, because there's too much iridodenesis that happens. And that definitely can lead to greater chafing of the posterior iris,
and dislocation
issues. Mm-hmm. So that is a good pearl. So Eric, do you choose glue fixation, as you mentioned, or Yamini? I mean, does it depend on the eye? How do you make that choice?
Well, I like both techniques very much, Liz. And I actually probably do a few more glued IOL, the Amar Agarwal technique. I think it's stable. I think it's a little less manipulation. But in this case, I don't like doing the Agarwal technique when the eye has already been opened, because you really need to have a good firm eye to do your flaps. And I find them much more difficult to do after you've opened the eye. So when I'm doing the Agarwal technique, I make my flaps first. That's the first thing I do while the eye is completely intact. This eye's already been open. So for me, this is going to be a Yamini technique. And by the way, I'll put a advertisement. I told you how Ascaris has really changed my life in so many positive ways. I was at Ascaris in 2016 when Shin Yamini presented this for the first time. And I said, it was like a light bulb. And when I said, that is amazing. That's the kind of thing where you go to the meeting and you come away with one pearl like that. And it changes your entire aspect on how you manage patients. So that's the beauty of going to the Ascaris meeting, is to go and learn these things that you would miss otherwise. So I'm going to do this technique. And I did not put in a infusion port at this time. I'll put one in a little bit later. But this is the classic Yamini technique. You start about 2 millimeters posterior to the limbus. You want to go about 2 millimeters. You want to angle down. You want to mark your spots. And then you're going to basically feed in the haptics. Now, I don't love using a proline haptic. That's the other thing about the Amar Agarwal stick that I really like very much, is that there's a lot less manipulation to the haptics. And I've kinked these haptics. I've broken them off. I really think that having the right IOL is so important. And the Zeiss CT Lucia is the lens of choice for doing the Imani technique. You just can't get them. They're not available all the time. These proline haptics are a problem. You want a PBDF haptic. And here you see me pulling the haptic through. And now a lot of people will put the second haptic in before they do this. I like to just put this, I want to make sure I'm not going to lose it. So I'm basically making my flange there with a low temp quarter. And while I'm doing that, the lens is dislocated again.
Right.
Right.
So, yeah. Right. Yeah, they're actually PMMA haptics on this one. But, you know, the thing is, I think when we first started doing, well, my first Yamani, I don't know if you remember, Eric.
I want my mommy.
I did a Yamani, Yamani and I want my mommy. I went the same way. So I didn't follow the actual angulation of the haptics. But anything can happen. We tried this way. This way is a little bit more difficult when you pull it all the way out, because then you don't leave the trailing haptic outside the eye to get it better on the second throw of your needle. So keep going, Eric. This is awesome.
What I did, I think I put too much of the haptic into the needle. Uh-huh. And I pulled it out too far.
Right.
And that's why, so if I put, I had too much haptic showing there, and that's why I fell down. I've done this 50 times. This is the only time that this happened this way. But as I said before, now I'm ready for plan C.
Or D.
I move on. I how many times do you get in quicksand twice in the same eye? So
where's your infusion? Like, do you think if you had infusion in the eye, if the lens may have stayed put a little better?
No, I think the infusion might have made it worse, actually, in that it might have forced it down. But at this point, now I need infusion. So you're absolutely right. I do need it now. And I could have used it before, actually, as well. So at this point, the knee-jerk response is to go and reach for that lens with a MST. But you don't want to be putting instruments into the vitreous and pulling that up. That's just a disaster waiting to happen. So what I'm going to do here is I'm going to come out. And I'm going to start over with next steps, and that is to put an infusion in and to do a pars plana vitrectomy. And I like to use a trocar and a 25-gauge sutureless vitrectomy. There's a lot of good ones. This happens to be the Signature Pro. And I'm putting my infusion port in, and I'm going to do a vitrectomy. And I'm going to use the vitreous cutter to actually cut the vitreous, remove the vitreous, and I'm also going to use it to push the lens up. The lens is anchored very securely by the flange. And I'm just going to push it up into the anterior chamber, grab it with a MST forceps, and bring it back into the anterior chamber. Now I'm in a safe position again, where the lens is up in the anterior chamber, and I can proceed. And at this point, I very simply want to complete my Yamani technique by putting in my 30-gauge needle. Sometimes I'll actually cut the haptic, but I want to basically just make my little flange. I make the flange. I rotate it back into the position. The lens is perfectly centered. And I've completed the case, and it's a perfect eye. I mean, it's like nothing happened. See how you can make all those mistakes on one eye, and it can, if you handle it well, you have your plan A, B, C, and D, the eye does well. And this patient obviously did very well also. And that's my quicksand moments that I was so happy to share with you.
In all seriousness, Eric, I mean, we really appreciate you showing this, because if anyone's really doing these cases, this has happened. This has happened to me. What do you think the takeaway points that you learned from this case that you know you're never going to do again because this happened?
There are a couple of things here, Nicole. I think the thing is, watch the trailing haptic. Make certain that trailing haptic is in a position where you can control it. Either have it outside of the eye or have it fixated inside the eye where nothing can happen to it. This would be a place where an extra pair of hands holding that haptic would have been a great thing. Having infusion in place is a great idea as well. But in retrospect, I think that the take-home message here is basically don't lose your cool, stay stable, evaluate the circumstance, and again, have your plan and have your backup plan, as we've mentioned before. And the shout-out that I give that I've done before today is, again, thank you to Ascaris for all this. I learned how to do pars plana vitrectomies from Ascaris. I learned how to do the Imani technique. So many learning moments. And you two wonderful women are continuing that learning, that education of what makes ASCRS a special organization, continuing your podcast and allowing so many people to learn from our mistakes and to become better surgeons because of your involvement in this program. And I'm so appreciative of being here with you today because this is what it's all about. It's about friendship. It's about making ophthalmology a better profession. And there's no two people who do it better than the both of you.
Oh, goodness. You're so kind. Can I ask for you to share just one more pearl? Postoperatively with the steroids, do you keep it on for longer than your normal routine? I'm sure you do it at a higher dosage, but do you maintain it for maybe 2, 3, 4 months?
A couple of things as far as anti-inflammatory. You know, my philosophy on anti-inflammatory and Ed Holland, my partner in crime on so many of these things, we've been saying this for a long time. Inflammation should not be controlled. It should be eliminated. We never want to allow inflammation to play a significant role. So this is a case where I probably would have put some triamcinolone in the eye at the time of this, at the end of the surgery, number one. I would have put this patient on postoperative difluprednate, Durezol, the strongest steroid we have topically available today. I would have done it 4 times a day. And I probably would keep this patient on a topical nonsteroidal for probably 2 months as well.
Well, thank you so much for being here, Eric. And thank you to the listeners. We really appreciate you listening to our podcast, tuning in, and make sure you give us any feedback and questions at quicksandchronicles@ascrs.org. And please remember to watch and subscribe to the YouTube channel for future episodes of our podcast. You can also listen and subscribe on Apple, Spotify, Google Podcasts, and please remember that we want your feedback. And we've had wonderful interactions with all these people from all over the world. And it's really amazing to us, and we want to keep the conversation going. Also want to say a special shout out to our sponsors, OSRX and BVI, for allowing us to be able to put this podcast on and continue the Quicksand Chronicles.
And thank you, Eric, for sharing your time with us. Thank you for coming dressed to the nines for the occasion and all of the great wisdom that you were able to impart. So,
and remember, we're here for you. And every time you think you have the eyeball figured out, it's going to humble you.
We hope these collective experiences help you develop grace under pressure. Thank you and see you next time.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of the Ophthalmology Quicksand Chronicles with Drs. Nicole Fram and Elizabeth Yu, where hindsight really is 2020.